"Sell them," Santain said quietly, and heard him choke at the end of the line. "If I may be permitted to offer a word of advice..." "Sell them," she repeated. "Sell all of them." And she hung up, staring out of the window as she tried to calculate her profits. But the telephone rang again before she reached a total, and one after another her brokers triumphantly reported on the contracts she had made. Then there was a call from Windhoek. "Dr. Twentyman Jones, it's so good to hear your voice." She had recognized him instantly.
"Well, Mrs. Courtney, this is a pretty pickle," Twentyman Jones told her glumly. "The Harney mine will be back in profit again now, even with the parsimonious quota De Beers is allowing us."
"We've turned the corner," Santain enthused. "We are out of the woods."
"Many a slip twixt cup and lip,"
gloomily Twentyman Jones capped cliché with cliché.
"Best not to count our chickens, Mrs. Courtney."
"Dr. Twentyman Jones, I love you," Santain laughed delightedly, and there was a shocked silence that echoed across 1,000 miles of wire. "I'll be there just as soon as I can get away from here. There is a lot for us to work on now."
She hung up and went to look for Chasseur. He was down at the stables, chatting with his coloured grooms, as they sat in the sun, dubbing his polo harness and saddlery.
"Cherie, I'm driving into Cape Town. Will you come with me?"
"What are you going all that way for, mater?" he asked.
"It's a surprise."
That was the one certain way to gain Chasseur's full attention, and he tossed the harness he was working on to Abel and sprang to his feet. Her ebullient mood was infectious, and they were laughing together as they walked into Porter's Motors showroom on Strand Street. The sales manager came from his cubicle on the run.
"Mrs. Courtney, we haven't seen you in far too long. May I wish you a happy and prosperous new year."
"It's off to a good start on both counts," she smiled. "And speaking of happiness, Mr. Timms, how soon can you deliver my new Daimler?"
"It will be yellow, naturally."
"With black piping, naturally."
"And the usual fittings?" he queried. "The vanity, the cocktail cabinet?"
"All of them, Mr. Timms."
"I will cable our London office immediately. Shall we say 4 months, Mrs. Courtney?"
"Let us rather say 3 months, Mr. Timms."
Chasseur could barely contain himself until they were on the pavements in front of the showroom.
"Mater, have you gone bonkers? We are paupers."
"Well, Cherie, let's be paupers with a little class and style."
"Where are we going now?"
"The post office," she said. And at the telegraph counter, Santain drafted a cable to Sotheby's in Bond Street, which read,
"Sale no longer contemplated. Stop. Please cancel all preparations."
Then they went to lunch at the Mount Nelson Hotel. Blaine had promised to meet her as early as he was able to escape from the meeting of the proposed new coalition cabinet. He was as good as his word, waiting for her in the pine forest, and when she saw his face, her happiness shriveled.
"What is it, Blaine?"
"Let's walk, Santain. I've been indoors all day."
They climbed the Carbon-Kelberg slopes behind the estate. At the summit, they sat on a fallen log to watch the sunset, and it was magnificent.
"This was the fairest cape which we discovered in all our circumnavigation of the earth," she misquoted from Vasco da Gama's log. But Blaine did not correct her, as she had hoped he might.
"Tell me, Blaine."
She took his arm and insisted, and he turned his face to her.
"Isabella," he said somberly.
"You have heard from her?"
Her spirits sank deeper at the name.
The doctors can do nothing for her. She will be returning on the next mail ship from Southampton. In the silence, the sun sank into the silver sea, taking the light from the world, and Santaine's soul was as dark. "How ironic it is," she whispered. "Because of you, I can have anything in this world except that which I most desire. You, my love." The women pounded the fresh millet grain in the wooden mortars into a coarse, fluffy white meal and filled one of the leather sacks. Carrying the sack, Svart Hendrik, followed by Moses, his brother, left the kraal after the rise of the new moon and crept silently up the ridge in the night. While Hendrik stood guard, Moses climbed to the old eagle owl nest in the leadwood tree and brought down the cartridge paper packets. They moved along the ridge until they were beyond all possible chance of observation from the village, and even then they very carefully screened the small fire that they built amongst the ironstone boulders. Hendrik broke open the packets and poured the gleaming stones into a small calabash gourd, while Moses prepared the millet meal in another gourd, mixing it with water until it was a soft porridge. Meticulously, Hendrik burned the cartridge paper wrappings in the fire and stirred the ashes to powder with a stick. When it was done, he nodded at his younger brother, and Moses poured the dough over the coals. As it began to bubble, Hendrik buried the diamonds in the unleavened dough. Moses muttered ruefully as the millet cakes bubbled and hardened. It was almost an incantation. "These are death stones. We will have no joy of them. The white men love them too dearly. They are the stones of death and madness." Hendrik ignored him and, shaking the baking loaves, squinting his eyes against the smoke and smiling secretly to himself. When each round loaf was crisp brown on the underside, he flipped it over and let it cook through until it was brick hard. Then he lifted it off the fire and set it out to cool. Finally, he repacked the crude, thick loaves into the leather sack, and they returned quietly to the sleeping village. In the morning they left early, and the women went with them the first mile of the journey, ululating mournfully and singing the song of farewell. When they fell behind, neither of the men looked back. They trudged on towards the low brown horizon, carrying their bundles balanced on their heads. They did not think about it, but this little scene was acted out every single day in 1,000 villages across the southern subcontinent. Days later, the two men, still on foot, reached the recruitment station. It was a single-roomed general dealer's store, standing alone at a remote crossroad on the edge of the desert. The white trader augmented his precarious business by buying cattle hides from the surrounding nomadic tribes and by recruiting for Vuenela. Vuenela was the acronym for the Witwatersrand Native Labour Association, a ubiquitous, sprawling enterprise which extended its tentacles into the vastness of the African wilderness. From the peaks of the Dragon Mountains in Basutoland to the swamps of the Zambezi and Chobe, from the thirst lands of the Kalahari to the rainforest of the high plateau of Nyasaland, it gathered up the trickle of black men and channeled them first into a stream and finally into a mighty river that ran endlessly to the fabulous gold fields of the Ridge of White Waters, the Witwatersrand of Transvaal. The trader looked over these two new recruits in a perfunctory manner as they stood dumbly before him. Their faces were deliberately expressionless, their eyes blank, the only perfect defence of the black African in the presence of the white man. Name? The trader demanded. Henry Tabaka.
Hendrik had chosen his new name to cover his relationship to Moses and to throw off any chance connection with Lothar de la Rey and the robbery.
Name?
The trader looked at Moses.
Moses Garmer.
He pronounced it with a guttural G.
Have you worked on the mines before? Do you speak English?
Yes, Bazi.
They were obsequious, and the trader grinned.
Good. Very good. You'll be rich men when you come home from Goldie. Plenty of wives? Plenty of jig-jig, hey?
He grinned lavishly as he issued them each with a green vanilla card and a bus ticket.
The bus will come soon. Wait outside, he ordered,
and promptly lost all interest in them. He had earned his guinea-a-head recruitment fee, good money easily made, and his obligation to the recruits was at an end. They waited under the scraggy thorn tree at the side of the iron-roofed trading store for 48 hours before the railway's bus came rattling and banging and blowing blue smoke across the dreary wastes. It stopped briefly, and they slung their meagre luggage up onto the roof rack that was already piled with calabashes and boxes and bundles, with trussed goats and cages of woven bark stuffed with live fowls. Then they climbed into the overloaded coach and squeezed onto one of the hard wooden benches. The bus bellowed and blustered on over the plains, and the rows of black passengers, wedged shoulder to shoulder, jolted and swayed in unison as it pitched and rolled over the rutted tracks. 2 days later, the bus stopped outside the barbed wire gates of the Vanilla staging post on the outskirts of Windhoek, and most of the passengers, all young men, descended and stood looking about them aimlessly, until a huge black overseer, with brass plaques of authority on his arm and a long jambok in his hand, chivered them into line and led them through the gates. The white station manager sat on the stoop of his office building, his boots propped on the half wall of the stoop and a black bottle of German lager at his elbow, fanning himself with his hat. One at a time, the black boss boy pushed the new recruits in front of him for appraisal. He rejected only one, a skinny little runt of a man who barely had the strength to shuffle up to the veranda.
That bastard is riddled with TB.
The manager took a gulp of his lager.
Get rid of him. Send him back where he came from.
When Hendrik stepped forward, he straightened up in his thonged chair and set down the lager glass.
What is your name, boy?
He asked.
Tabaka. Ha! You speak English.
The manager's eyes narrowed. He could pick out the troublemakers. That was his job. He could tell by their eyes, the gleam of intelligence and aggression in them. He could tell by the way they walked and carried their shoulders. This big, strutting, sullen black was big trouble.
You in trouble with the police, boy?
He asked again.
You steal other man's cattle? You kill your brother, perhaps? Or jig-jig his wife, hey?
Hendrik stared at him flatly.
Answer me, boy.
No.
You call me Baas when you speak to me, do you understand?
Yes, Baas,
Hendrik said carefully. And the manager opened the police file that lay on the table beside him and thumbed through it slowly. Suddenly looking up, to catch any sign of guilt or apprehension on Hendrik's face. But he was wearing the African mask again, dumb and resigned and inscrutable.
Christ, they stink! He threw the file back onto the table again. Take them away, he told the black boss boy,
and he picked up his beer bottle and glass and went back into his office.
You know better than that, my brother,
Moses whispered to him as they were marched away towards the line of thatched huts.
When you meet a hungry white hyena, you do not put your hand in his mouth.
And Hendrik did not reply.
They were fortunate. The draft was almost full. 300 black men already gathered in and waiting in the line of huts behind the barbed wire fence. Some of them had been there 10 days, and it was time for the next stage of their journey. Thus, Hendrik and Moses were not forced to endure another interminable wait. That night, 3 railway coaches were shunted onto the spur of line that ran beside the camp, and the boss boys roused them before dawn.
"Gather your belongings! Sha'ili, the hour has struck! The steamer waits to take you to Goldie, to the place of gold!"
They formed up in their ranks again and answered to the roll call. Then they were marched to the waiting coaches. Here there was another white man in charge. He was tall and sun-browned. His khaki shirt sleeves rolled up high on his sinewy biceps, and wisps of blonde hair hanging from under the shapeless black hat that was pulled low down on his forehead. His features were flat and Slavic. His teeth crooked and stained with tobacco smoke, and his eyes were light misty blue. He smiled perpetually, in a bland, idiotic fashion, and sucked at a cavity in one of his back teeth. He carried a jambok on a thong from his wrist, and now and then, for no apparent reason, he flicked the tapered end of the hippo hide whip against the bare legs of one of the men filing past him. It was a casual act, born of disinterest and disdain, rather than calculated cruelty. And though each stroke was feathery light, it stung like a hornet, and the victim gasped and skipped and shot up the ladder into the coach with alacrity. Hendrik drew level with him, and the foreman's lips drew back from his bad teeth as he smiled even more widely. The camp manager had pointed out the big Ovambo to him. "A bad one," he had warned him. "Watch him. Don't let him get out of hand." And now he used his wrist in the stroke that he aimed at the tender skin at the back of Hendrik's knee.
"Chicha!"
the overseer ordered. "Hurry up!" And the lash popped as it wrapped around Hendrik's leg. It did not split the skin. The overseer was an expert. But it left a purple-black welt on the dark, velvety skin. Hendrik stopped dead. The other leg lifted to the first rung of the boarding ladder, gripping the rail with his free hand, with the other hand balancing his bundle on his shoulder. And he turned his head slowly until he was staring into the overseer's pale blue eyes. "Yes?" the overseer encouraged him softly, and for the first time there was a sparkle of interest in his eyes. He altered his stance subtly, coming onto the balls of his feet. "Yes?" he repeated. He wanted to take this big black bastard here in front of all the others. There were going to be 5 days in these coaches, 5 hot, thirsty days, during which tempers and nerves would be rubbed raw. He always liked to do it right at the beginning of the journey. It only needed one, and it would save a lot of trouble later if he made an example right here on the siding. That way all of them would know what to expect if they started anything. And in his experience, they never did start anything after that. "Come on, Kaffir." He dropped his voice even lower, making the insult more personal and intense. He enjoyed this part of his work, and he was very good at it. This cocky bastard would not be fit to travel when he had finished with him. He wouldn't be much use to anybody, with 4 or 5 ribs stoved in, and perhaps a broken jaw. Hendrik was too quick for him.
He went up the ladder into the coach in a single bound, leaving the overseer on the siding, braced and poised for his attack, with the jambok held overhand, ready to drive the point of the butt into Hendrik's throat as he charged. Hendrik's move took him completely off balance, so that when he aimed a hard cut of the lash at Hendrik's legs as he went up the ladder, he was too late by a full half second, and the stroke hissed and died in air. Following behind his brother, Moses saw the murderous expression on the white overseer's face as he passed. "It is not yet ended," he warned Hendrik, as they placed their bundles on the overhead racks and settled on the hard wooden bench that ran the length of the coach. "He will come after you again." In the middle of the morning, the three coaches were pulled off the spur and coupled to the rear of a long train of goods carriages. And after another few hours of shunting and jolting and false starts, they rumbled slowly up the hills and then ran southwards. Late in the afternoon, the train stopped for half an hour at a small siding, and a food barrow was loaded into the leading coach. Under the pale eyes of the white overseer, the two black boss boys wheeled the barrow down the crowded coaches, and each of the recruits was handed a small tin dish of white maize cake, over which a dollop of bean stew had been spooned. When they reached Svart Hendrik's seat, the white overseer shouldered the boss boy aside and took the dish from his hands to serve Hendrik's portion himself. "We must look after this Kaffir," he said loudly. "We want him to be strong for his work at Goldie." And he spooned an extra portion of bean stew into the dish and offered it to Hendrik. "Here, Kaffir." But as Hendrik reached for the dish, he deliberately let it drop onto the floor. The hot stew splashed over Hendrik's feet, and the overseer stepped into the mess of maize porridge and ground it under his boot. Then he stood back with one hand on the billy club in his belt and grinned. "Hey, you clumsy black bugger! You only get one ration. If you want to eat it off the floor, that's up to you." He waited expectantly for Hendrik to react, and then grimaced with disappointment when Hendrik dropped his eyes, leaned forward, and began to scrape the mashed cake into the dish with his fingers, then scooped a ball of it into his mouth and munched on it stolidly. "You bloody niggers will eat anything, even your own dung," he snarled and went on down the coach. The windows of the coaches were barred, and the doors at both ends were locked and bolted from the outside. The overseer carried the ring of keys on his belt, carefully securing all doors behind him as he passed. From experience, he knew that many of the recruits would begin to have misgivings as soon as the journey began, and driven by homesickness and increasing fear of the unknown, by the disturbing unfamiliarity of all about them, would begin to desert, some of them even leaping from the speeding coach. The overseer made his rounds every few hours, meticulously counting heads, even in the middle of the night. And he stood over Hendrik deliberately, shining the beam of his lantern into his face, waking him every time he passed down the coach. The overseer never tired of his efforts to provoke Hendrik. It had become a challenge, a contest between them. He knew it was there. He had seen it in Hendrik's eyes, just a flash of the violence and menace and power, and he was determined to bring it out, flush it into the open where he could crush it and destroy it. "Patience, my brother," Moses whispered to Hendrik. "Hold your anger. Cherish it with care. Let it grow until it is full term, until you can put it to work for you." Hendrik was coming to rely more on his brother's advice and counsel with each day that passed. Moses was intelligent and persuasive,
his tongue quick to choose the right word. And that special presence which he possessed made other men listen when he spoke. Hendrik saw these special gifts of his demonstrated clearly in the days that followed. At first, he spoke only to the men that sat near him in the hot, crowded coach. He told them what it would be like at the place where they were going, and how the white men would treat them, what would be expected of them, and what the consequences would be if they disappointed their new employers. The black faces around him were intent as they listened, and soon those further up the benches were craning to catch his words and calling softly, "Speak louder, Gamma. Speak, that all of us may hear your words." Moses Gamma raised his voice, a clear, compelling baritone, and they listened with respect. "There will be many black men at Goldie, more than you ever believed possible. Zulus and Hosas and Ndebeles and Swazis and Nyasas, 50 different tribes, speaking so many different languages that you have never heard before. Tribes as different from you as you are different from the white man. Some of them will be traditional blood enemies of our tribe, waiting and watching like hyenas for a chance to turn upon you and savage you. There will be times when you are deep in the earth, down there where it is always night, that you will be at the mercy of such men. To protect yourselves, you must surround yourselves with men you can trust. You must place yourself under the protection of a strong leader. And in return for this protection, you must give this chieftain your obedience and loyalty." And very soon they came to recognize that Moses Gama was this strong leader. Within days, he was the undisputed chieftain of all the men in Coach 3. And while he was talking to them and answering their queries, stilling their fears and misgivings, Moses was, in his turn, assessing their individual worth, watching and weighing each of them, selecting, evaluating, and discarding. He began to rearrange the seating in the coach, ordering those whom he had chosen to move closer to his own seat in the center, gathering around him the pick of the recruits. And immediately the men he had singled out gained prestige. They formed an elite Praetorian guard around their new emperor. Hendrik watched him doing it, manipulating the men around him, subjecting them to the force of his will and personality, and he was filled with admiration and pride for his younger brother, giving up his own last reservations and willingly according to him his full loyalty and love and obedience. By association with Moses, Hendrik himself was accorded the respect and veneration of the other men in the coach. He was Moses' captain and henchman, and they recognized him as such. And quite slowly it dawned upon Hendrik that in a few short days, Moses Gama had forged himself an impi, a band of warriors on whom he could rely implicitly, and that he had done it with almost no apparent effort. Sitting in the crowded coach that was already stinking like an animal cage, with the rancid sweat of 100 hot bodies, and with the stench from the latrine cubicle, and mesmerized by the messianic eyes and words of his own brother, Hendrik thought back to the other great black rulers who had emerged from the mists of African history, to lead first a tiny band, then a tribe, and finally a vast horde of warriors across the continent, ravaging and plundering and laying waste. He thought of Mantatizi and Shaka, and Mzilizakazi, of Shangan and Angoni, and with a flash of clairvoyance he saw them at their beginnings, sitting like this at some remote campfire in the wilderness, surrounded by a small group of men, weaving the spell over them, capturing their imagination and spirit with a silken noose of words and ideas, inflaming them with dreams. "I stand at the beginning of an enterprise which I do not yet understand," he thought.
All I have done up till this time was only my initiation. All the fighting and killing and striving was but a training. Now I am ready for the endeavor, whatever it may be, and Moses Gama will lead me to it. I do not need to know what it is. It is sufficient only that I follow where it leads." And he was listening avidly, as Moses spoke names that he had never heard, and expounded ideas that were new and strangely exciting. "Lenin," said Moses, "was not a man, but a god come down to earth." And they thrilled to the tale of a land to the north, where the tribes had united under this man-god, Lenin, had smitten down a king, and in doing so had become part of the godhead themselves. They were enchanted and aroused as he told them of a war such as the earth had never seen before, and their atavistic battle lust scalded their veins and pumped up their hearts, hard and hot as the head of the fighting axe when it comes red and glowing from the ironsmith's forge. The revolution, Moses called this war, and as he explained it to them, they saw that they could be part of this glorious battle. They too could be slayers of kings and become part of the Godhead.